mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
Interestingly, purchase market, which, you know, we talked about it here, it's sort of been fickle. I think we're kind of like waiting to see where that, like, what is going to be that threshold that we hit from a rates perspective that is sort of like the escape velocity for the purchase market to really start humming again. So we've been fickle. Obviously, the rate market has improved. And so we've seen the refi market, but purchase market has been tricky. So I never really know what to expect. December, though, I think some pretty good reason for optimism.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to 2026. We skipped a week here, so a little bit to talk about, although a little bit slow around the holidays in terms of data, but still a lot going on in geopolitics and a little bit to talk about with the Fed. So we've got a great show for you today, and just in the interest of making sure you know what to watch as an originator, as a capital markets person, or just someone interested in the mortgage industry, we got some great market commentary coming up. We will also get to the Market Advantage. So as you know, Market Advantage is now part of the Optimal Insights podcast. We will touch on that with Brennan and Mike here right after the market update. Before we get to that, just in the way of data, OBMMI, 30-year fixed, still dragging the bottom of the sixes, 6.14, the 10-year Treasuries at 4.16. So seeing a little bit of compression continuously between those two numbers, just getting closer together, which is a good thing for mortgage rates, where you may not see treasury rates dip, but you may see mortgage rates continue to just reduce ever so slightly versus that benchmark number. Volume, we did see volume drop a bit right around the holiday. That's expected. We hadn't seen it all of December, which we typically do see, but we did see it drop right around the holiday, which, you know, a lot of folks are on vacation, they're visiting family. You wouldn't expect a ton of people to be locking loans, but there was some activity. We're about 50% of normal, which around the holidays, what we usually would see 15 to 20%. 50% is pretty healthy. Let's go check in with Alex and see what's going on with the market update. Okay, we are here with Alex. We have missed a couple weeks of 1 week of the podcast, 2 weeks of data, but not much really has come out, right? Because we had the week of Christmas since our last podcast, and then the week of New Year's. Obviously, a lot to talk about that has happened, which we'll get to here in a minute. There's the news out of Venezuela. Let's just start with what did happen since the 22nd in terms of data. What have we seen? We've seen some initial claims numbers. We've seen continuing claims, and as I think as James pointed out last time, those are a little lumpy right now because of some of the government severance packages running out from some of the Doge stuff that happened earlier in the year. What else do you see there?
Yeah, I think initial jobless claims, they've been where, aside from those kind of lumps that we saw coming out of the government shutdown numbers, which aligned with October, November payrolls, those were lumpy, which we can mainly attribute, we think, to layoffs from the Doge cuts and government cutbacks. The most recent numbers for initial jobless claims came out December 31st, at about 220,000 initial jobless claims, which is right in the range that we saw and talked about all of last year. Yeah, I mean, 250 is, that red flag warning that we keep talking about. And I'd say 220 is on the lower end of the band that we generally see. So somewhere between, like, you know, 210 and 240. No news is good news on that front. It's a nice weekly number that we get every week. But as of last week, it didn't point to too much distress in the labor market. We have been seeing the unemployment rate, as we know, tick up month over month for the past 3-4 releases now. I think we're sitting 4.4% or so on unemployment. And then the Fed has been talking about wanting to address that But for the time being, it seems to be that the labor market is in a stable position, if not, you know, the greenest of pastures.
Yeah. And we'll get the true survey number. Maybe the first real unemployment report that comes out on the right day since the government shut down, right, this week on Friday, and expecting, I don't know, I would guess I would call it lackluster, but still relatively healthy numbers coming out of that print, right? Expecting, let's see, 4.5 headline number, which is right at the cusp of where the Fed would really like to take action. And then payrolls are expected to be, what, 57,000?
Yeah, right in there. I mean, it'll be a weak reading regardless. But yeah, it seems to be in line with what we've come to expect. And like you said, this one's coming on time. We're finally back on track for the time being, at least. There's whispers out there that we could see another government shutdown. What got us back open last time was a continuing resolution debate some of those issues that were hotly contested back in October, November. In addition to that, they provided funding through January 30th. So if they can't get additional funding resolutions passed by January 30th, we will see another government shutdown and the associated data latency that we saw with the last one.
Right. I mean, most of the drama is going to be around the Affordable Care Act, right? That was the one point that kept the shutdown going for so long and has now kind of kicked the can down the road. And now we're actually having to reckon with that before the end of this month.
Yeah. And it's the Affordable Care Act has gotten further than I thought that it would. What the Democrats were able to secure out of the last shutdown was they were going to vote on if they will address the Affordable Care Act. And they got the votes, I believe, right before Congress went on holiday for the holidays. I think there were four Republicans that defected that got them across the line to over more than 50 votes in the Senate. So they will be addressing it. And it does seem to be something that they're going to have to address because the cost of healthcare, I think at this point, crosses party lines on how the voters feel about it.
Big time. No, I think folks were glad to see there a little bit of dissension. There are some folks breaking ranks, at least temporarily for this issue, because there didn't seem to be an end in sight. And to your point, we've talked about it on the podcast, like there are a lot of red states that heavily depend on the Affordable Care Act. A lot of small businesses, farm, agriculture, they don't have the size or the scale, the economies of scale to have kind of the type of healthcare that some of us have in larger businesses. So they're hurting a lot of their voters potentially going into an election year, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it would be a big sore spot for the Republicans heading into the election year if they were to not even address the Affordable Care Act. You know, it still might not pass, but the fact that they've been able to bring it to a vote and debate it, I think will help them in the long term. And I do see it passing with the dissensions that we saw. I think four dissensions, and, you know, they got to 52, 53 votes, which is you know, a few more than that 50 that they need. So I'm hopeful that they're able to get something done there. And if they're able to get something done on the Affordable Care Act, that seems to be the major roadblock. That's what Democrats were holding out for throughout the entirety of the last government shutdown. So if they can get the Affordable Care Act done, I think they can get a budget done as well.
Very good. Good to hear. Yeah, assuming that gets done, we don't have another government shutdown. We'll probably be focused on the Fed again. We talked about that on the last two podcasts, just, you know, the drama that happened in 25 and likely a lot of turnover coming in this year in 26. I mean, what's been new over the past couple of weeks there? You got a couple of notes here. I mean, just generally speaking, should we be expecting a bit of just more of the lame duck situation, or do we actually have some activity here in the next few months?
Yeah. In regards to the Fed, the big question mark remains of who is going to be Powell's successor. Is it going to be Kevin Warsh or Kevin Hamill? You know, that's kind of up to Trump at this point on who he's going to nominate. You know, it seems like the headlines go back and forth as, you know, whispers come out to press. I think the biggest change, and this is just a matter of routine at the Fed, is the Board of Governors rotates through voting rolls, and those roles exchange at the end of the year. And so we have new voting members this year, Beth Hammack of the Cleveland Fed, Lori Logan of the Dallas Fed, Anna Paulson of the Philadelphia Fed, and Neil Kashkari of the Minneapolis Fed are all going to be voting members this year. They were previously just on the Bank of or the Board of Governors. And Collins, Goolsbee, Muslim, and Schmid are out as voting members. This is just a matter of routine on keeping the voting members cycling through from the Board of Governors I was looking at kind of the voting history of these new ones versus the old ones, you know, how hawkish, how dovish they are. There's maybe a slightly more hawkish lean to them. Lori Logan and Neil Kashkari in particular lean hawkish. Paulson of the Philadelphia Fed is more dovish, but I don't really expect a major change there. These are all like kind of holdovers from pre-Trump era for the most part. And they're more of the old guard like Powell is, you know, in keeping with Fed independence and such. So I don't expect them to vote radically different than the former ones. But again, it's a matter of routine. It's good to know that, you know, how the Fed works.
Yeah, well, that's good information. I think we forget that that does happen every year. And thanks for doing that analysis. So it sounds like you said, not a huge change. Yeah. or no expectation that the rate path is going to change because of the makeup of the voters on the board. So we'll have to wait to see who the new chairperson is, which certainly can change the tide significantly, because as we've pointed out in the past, when the Fed is kind of leaning one way over the fence, certainly if the chairperson is, that's the way that most members will then vote. Versus now, where we kind of have this weird situation where we do have a little bit of a split.
And then final point on the Fed is just Myron. Again, his position was temporary because Kugler left mid-year last year. And so he was just filling in for the remainder of Kugler's term. He will vote at the January meeting. I expect him to vote as he's been voting for a, you know, 50 basis point cut. But Trump will then get to nominate an additional member of the Board of Governors there.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. All right. So more to come on the Fed as we get into this first quarter. And I guess last but not least, Venezuela happened over the holiday, kind of when very few people were probably watching the news, or, you know, markets are closed. It was, you know, you wouldn't know it today. The markets are open today. You wouldn't know that there was a relatively major global political change over the New Year's holiday. And that was that essentially the U.S. has taken control of Venezuela by arresting the sitting leader of Venezuela and likely some others. And where does that go from here, right? We're kind of in, a tenuous spot geopolitically, but it hasn't seemed to do much for the markets. But it is something that everybody needs to be aware of and paying attention to, and probably reading into a bit more than what you've seen in the headlines over the last 4 to 6 months, right? I mean, I think we've all seen the videos of the drug boats being blown up in the Caribbean, presumably headed towards the U.S. And so a lot of the messaging there was drug trafficking, right, is the reason that we were amassing military hardware off the coast of Venezuela. But now, obviously, you know, if you read a little bit more into that, there is an economic impact here. There's an economic consideration that has a lot to do with fuel, right, oil and the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, the Trump 2 presidency, just in general, they've been far more, I think, prepared than the Trump 1 presidency. They've had the groundwork laid to get work done across the board. And they're really kind of kicking off year 2 here from the foreign policy perspective with a very, call it Teddy Roosevelt, walk with a big stick way of going about things. But yeah, as to what you said, you know, just to make sure everyone's aware, you know, what the U.S. did was a limited strike inside Venezuela, managed to arrest Nicolas Maduro and his wife, who are the leader and the first lady of that country, extradited them to New York on drug trafficking and weapons charges. And then, so he will face trial in New York on those charges. We'll see what comes of that. But at the end of the day, it's not really about that so much as the fact that, you know, if the leader of a foreign country has been extradited to the United States, what that means for that foreign country. You know, Trump has said, you know, we're in charge of Venezuela now. I wouldn't quite say that. I mean, yes, we've taken the leader of the country, but there's still the entire, you know, Maduro bureaucracy that's still running the day-to-day operations of the country, right? So it's really kind of a gray area at this point of what next. The United States historically is extremely strong on, you know, rapid and overwhelming strikes as we were here, but it doesn't quite seem that we know what the next step is. Yeah, I'm with you. I think that the drug trafficking story is nice politics, but Venezuela has the largest proven reserves in the world. It's right on our doorstep. So yeah, I think, and I mean, Trump's been open about saying that if, you know, U.S. oil companies want to, you know,
invest.
invest. They need to put their own capital forward into Venezuela. So I don't think it's any secret what's going on there.
Right. Yeah. The whole story has just been super interesting, how it's been able to keep the true plans quite secret. Meanwhile, everybody, like the news all over the world, knew that we were amassing this hardware and 15,000 troops off of Venezuela, but nobody knew what was going to happen and when. And it maybe speaks to a bit of the erratic nature of the administration right now and the element of surprise. But it was, anyway, interesting to watch. I think obviously concern for anyone involved in a conflict. It sounds like this was relatively nonviolent, but there's certainly people killed, I'm sure, at least within Venezuela, just looking at the videos and the explosions and all, it's almost impossible that there wasn't. But yeah, there's no, what is the next step? Is, you know, we've threatened other countries as well in regards to the narcotics coming into the U.S. and that we could take action, although it does seem like we're focused squarely on Venezuela at the moment. And then, like you said, there's the whole element of oil and the dollar denomination of oil, which is, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's ever been under true threat, but maybe, you know, recently there's more of a concern about that. So there might be, I don't know, reason to take action in other countries, but very interested to see how this plays out. For now, rates haven't moved because of it. We haven't seen much move in the equity markets. I mean, gold and silver are up big again today, but that just seems to happen every 3 or 4 days, not necessarily a reaction to this. So there's probably more upward pressure on rates that are still just disallowing rates to go much lower.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that kind of speaks to how sticky those higher rates are. You know, I wouldn't say that this is a flight to safety, you know, flight to bonds type, we just entered a war type scenario, because we haven't entered a war. It's been a limited strike. All the U.S. troops are officially out of Venezuela at this point. Mm-hmm. But it does point to, you would expect, historically speaking, that it would have had a greater effect on rates than it did. So we'll continue to monitor the situation, but for the time being, it seems to continue to be business as usual. But we want to, you know, bring it up on the podcast today, just because it has been, you know, world breaking news. It has the potential to affect rates in quite a dramatic fashion if things were to escalate. In addition to, it's opened the door to for additional interdictions in Latin America. I don't think it's been any secret. In fact, I think Trump has plainly threatened the leaders of Colombia and Mexico. And I don't think it's any secret that we'd like to see regime change in Cuba as well. I mean, that's been U.S. policy for close to 70 years now.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is not unprecedented, but it's been a very long time since we've openly threatened and then actually pulled off an operation like this, where we've deposed a leader of a major world economic power. So
I guess it was actually 36 years to the day since we interdicted in Panama, which is the last time we did something in the Latin American sphere.
In Latin America. Gotcha. Yeah. Right. And you know, however many years since Iraq. Good. What else should we be thinking about here? We got the unemployment report Friday. We should be, you know, focused on that. Any additional, you know, geopolitical moves we might make here in the next couple of weeks, I think we'd have to hear something about what our plan is for Venezuela, because we've kind of left that hanging.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've cut the head off the snake, but it's a snake that can wriggle around for a while in regards to, like I said, the bureaucracy is still functioning in that country. They still have a vice president who will assume the presidential role. So we'll see what happens there. But it's no secret we want regime change. I do think, keep your eye on the geopolitics. And for the remainder of this week, your standout data point is going to be that unemployment rate.
Right. All right. Good stuff. Thanks very much, Alex. Good discussion. Yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, as promised, let's now transition over to Mike and Brennan with the Market Advantage segment.
Welcome, everybody, to the December Market Advantage review. Happy New Year, everyone. Brennan, what was your biggest, what's the best gift in your house this holiday season from Santa?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's the same for me as it was for my daughter. There's this little, like, kid projector that throws up books onto the wall. I don't know if you've seen this. I think Santa got it at Costco. My daughter loves it. She's three, which also means that we love it, because then she sits there and it gives us at least maybe two or three of the 30 books we read to her every day gets done by the little Dr. Seuss projector now instead of me. So I think that was the biggest win under the tree. How about in the Vogue house?
Same one. We actually had that one last year at our house, so it's okay. Very valuable.
Yeah.
You know, on the kid front, you know, my two boys are very into monster trucks right now. So we had lots of monster truck ramps, lots of monster trucks. You know, for myself, I was really happy that Penn State got a football coach. That since the last time we chatted, we did not, you know, Penn State did not hire Matt Campbell. So I'm still kind of, you know, basking in the glow of that. but enough about us. You know, let's turn it over to some of the data here. Brennan, why don't you kick us off with some of the origination trends that we saw here in December?
Yeah, I'll say sort of like a mild present to the industry was a slight uptick in volume in December, which I think would be relatively unexpected given the typical holiday slowdown. So we were up 2% in December and on a year-over-year basis, up 30%. So good, solid finish to the year 2025, certainly Q4 looking a lot stronger than Q4 2024. The month-over-month increase driven primarily by refis. No surprise there. So rate term volume up 13% from November and up 170% from the same time last year. Now, obviously coming from a really small denominator, 170% sounds like a really big number, but it's still certainly significant volume as our originators work to get every loan they can in the door to close out the year. Cash outs were up a more modest, just 1% on a month-over-month basis, but still a fairly significant 35% year-over-year. Interestingly, purchase market, which, you know, we talked about it here, it's sort of been fickle. I think we're kind of like waiting to see where that, like what is going to be that threshold that we hit from a rates perspective that is sort of like the escape velocity for the purchase market to really start humming again, the lock in effect to sort of get unlocked, for lack of a better term. So we've been fickle. Obviously, the rate market has improved, and so we've seen the refi market, but purchase market has been tricky. So I never really know what to expect. December, though, I think some pretty good reason for optimism. We were down just 1%, so basically flat from November, and you'd expect it to go down. And optimistically, purchase market volumes are up 7% year over year. So it's a nice conclusion to 2025 for sure. In the purchase market, as well as what we saw overall, given the refi volume that contributed there. The rates were flat to down in December, not a material change in terms of the rate environment for borrowers. The OBE30C, Optimal Blue 30-Year Conforming Index, that's the benchmark for the CME mortgage rate future. OBE30C, by the way, I'll reference it that way occasionally. It's the Bloomberg ticker for folks that might want to find our indexes on Bloomberg. Finished the month flat at about 6.14. FHA rates dropped just a point. They sit just below 6. They're at 5.98. VA rates fell 6 bips, 5.71. Jumbo rates dropped 3 bips to 6.41. Interestingly, the 10-year Treasury finished the month up about 14 basis points. With mortgage rates remaining flat, the increase in the 10-year effectively erased the entire spread widening that we saw in November between the 10-year and the OB30C. So kind of gave back all of that widening that we saw in November, and now we sit around 200 basis points in terms of the spread from the 10-year to the primary rate. A few other items here to note. Conforming production fell relative to all other production types in December. I don't know that I have a meaningful story there. DTI ratios for home buyers ticked slightly higher across all products, but I think the trend overall has been that DTI ratios came down in 2025, a little bit of alleviation on debt strain for the borrowers. So we were down about a full point across the board from the same time in 2024. And then just to conclude the year, final point is our non-QM share continued the rise, I would say. So we're just above 9% now. We hit 9% in November and ticked up a few more basis points in terms of market share in December. I would expect us to hit double digits just the way the trend is going in Q1 of next year. So I know, Mike, you've posted about it, talked a lot about it. Non-QM is going to be a story. It was a story this year. It's going to continue to be a story into 2026 and really a good opportunity for originators to go out and pick up volume in this emerging market. How about on the secondary side? What did we see?
Yeah, before I even jump into the secondary side, I posted something on LinkedIn about trends I'm looking at for next year, and non-QM obviously was one of them. I had to hold myself back and wait for number five of my five trends to talk about non-QM. And friend of the podcast, Dave Savage, actually called me out and wanted me to put a prediction out there for where non-QM would be next year. And I threw it out in that 12 to 13% range. So we'll see if I'm wrong. I probably will be wrong directionally somewhere, but I do think that some of the tea leaves have a continued kind of trend upwards there. You know, we saw it almost double this year from beginning to end. So if we saw another 50% increase, you know, we're somewhere in that 12 or 13% range, which would, I think everybody would be really excited about that if that came true. Let's jump over to the capital market side of the house. So the first stat that I wanted to call out is our best ever to mandatory spread. We saw that generally increase across the board. Now, this is what folks in the hedging world kind of look to observe to see how much extra, you know, money or capital they can make by hedging and then doing loan sales. So the 30-year conventional moved from 32 basis points to 34 basis points. And then the government 30 best effort mandatory spread went from 15 to 18. And in the 15-year, actually saw a large increase of almost 8 basis points from 31 to 39 basis points. Now, the 15-year has a lot less volume than the other ones, so we'll put that one to the side for right now. But generally, it's nice to see those positive increases. And on the whole, they're basically flat year over year. I think 30-year was up 2 basis points and for the conforming and was down a basis point for the 30-year government. So pretty flat year over year. Moving on to the next one is one of my favorites, is the hedge loan sales statistics. And the big jump here is that we saw the percentage of loans sold to bulk aggregators increase 200 basis points from 27% to 29%. And this basically came away from agency share. So whether it was agency MBS or agency cash window, both of those decreased about 100 basis points from November to December. Which is interesting. I think what you may have seen is potentially that lenders were trying to manage some type of representative mix or requirement from the agencies, and they may have done that already as we got through the course of the year, and price took back some more market share there. Another thing that I you know, another like kind of prediction I want to throw out there is I think, you know, we see this in this past year, the share of loans that went from an MBS securitization increased. It went from, you know, let's call it mid-30s to mid-40s over the course of the year, mostly at the behest of bulk or cash pricing. I kind of think we're going to see an increase of cash pricing this year. So it was 24% of the loan sales in December went to the cash window. You know, reading the tea leaves, if there is some type of, you know, event with Fannie and Freddie going public or a portion of their, you know, the shares going public, I think that the cash window is a way that the agencies can use to kind of potentially monitor and increase their profitability. So I could see a world where maybe some of that MBS share goes in through the cash window coming in and maybe middle 26. The next stat in our, this one's a little bit more ho-hum, kind of just status quo, is our loan sale by price. So month over month, not a big change here. You know, we saw 79% of the loans sold in November sold to the highest execution, same percentage in December at 79%. Same thing with the second best exit, it was 11 and 11. And then we saw the third execution, so selling to that third best price during your loan sale, increase a percent, whereas that fourth or worse decreased about a percent. So pretty ho-hum there. On the servicing side, you know, we saw an average, to your point, OBMMI, maybe down about a basis point month over month if we look at the average. But in terms of servicing value, typically when rates drop or are flat, you expect servicing to be about the same. We actually saw servicing values increase about 5 basis points. So moving from 1.09 to 1.14, a shade under 1.15. So we saw that multiple on servicing go from like a 4.35 to almost a 4.58. So I think what we're seeing there is maybe some investors start to make a play for some extra servicing rights at the end of the year. You know, maybe they hit certain thresholds and want to be a little bit more aggressive. But in general, I don't think anyone is complaining about that. And the last one that I want to call out, and maybe there's a through line between these two, is the average investors included in a loan sale. So for the last 5 months, it's been 11. So that means that when you send out a bid tape for loans to be bid on, you're seeing on average 11 investors respond back. In December, we actually bucked that trend and went up to 12. So this is interesting. Maybe there's new market players in play who are, you know, increasing their servicing bids, for example. And this is quite interesting because it's very different than what we saw last year. Around the same time last year, it was here in November or December, we saw it decrease to 8 investors being included in the loan sale, and then pop back up the next month to about 10 or 11. So this month around the holiday season, we saw the inverse of that, which I thought was interesting and wanted to highlight. But with that, that's the rundown here for December's Market Advantage. Appreciate everybody, and you'll be hearing from us here shortly.
Happy New Year.
Okay, let's close this thing out. Thanks so much, Alex, Brennan, Mike. Great insights today. Everybody out there, come see us at the summit, the Optimal Blue Summit in Scottsdale, coming up here pretty quick next month in February. Check out our website at summit.optimalblue.com to register. And don't forget to drop us a note at podcast@optimalblue.com. We definitely want to hear from you. And that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Speed matters in lending, and borrowers expect instant answers. But traditional loan locking ties you to a desk, slowing decisions and creating friction. That's why Optimal Blue introduced mobile locking in our mobile app. Now, loan officers can lock loans anytime, anywhere, fast, secure, and accurate. Access your live pipeline, update loan details, run pricing, and complete locks right from your phone. No delays, no desk dependency. Just instant action that enhances the borrower experience. Unlike browser-based tools, mobile locking is built into our native iOS and Android app for faster load times, stronger security, and a seamless experience. And the best part? It's included at no extra cost for all Optimal Blue PPE users. Download the Optimal Blue mobile app today and start locking loans on the go. Access, price, lock, it's that simple.